paper.
Welcome to episode 26 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Melissa Potter in the papermaking studio at Columbia College, Chicago. Through her practice, which includes art making, writing, curating, and teaching, Melissa focuses on traditions that are endangered, underpaid, and underrecognized due to industrialization, war, gender bias, and globalization. We talk about her Quaker upbringing that instilled her desire to be an activist, how she expanded upon the papermaker's garden that I initiated at Dudenay Paper Mill in the mid-90s, and how she has continued to develop that as a socially engaged practice. We also discuss her career path as an advocate for artists at the New York Foundation for the Arts, her work through the Fulbright Program to build paper studios at the University of Serbia and the University of Sarajevo, and her current position as Associate Professor of Art and Art History at Columbia College, Chicago, where some of her goals are to give students who may never have access to a papermaking studio after college a transformative experience, and to document the legacy of hand papermaking as a craft form in the United States.
Hi, Helen. It's so awesome to see you here in Chicago.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Do you have a first memory of paper? Just curious.
I have a funny one, actually. I had a professor named George Lorio at Guilford College, and we were in a sculpture class, and he recommended that I go to the Greensboro, North Carolina Dyety Wash to get the lint out of the dryers and mix it with glue as like a low-cost sculpture material. They didn't dry quick enough for my crit, so I put them in the oven, and my entire dorm smelled like sweat socks. That was it for me, basically. You know, the minute I touched the material, I continued making and have been doing so ever since.
Wow. Okay, cool. And so why do you think he thought that? You must have been...
I think that a lot of sculptors, you know, in my interviews recently with paper makers, a lot of sculptors are looking for a material that is light and pliable and also has a very particular finish and look when it's packed into a mold, for instance. So my guess with him is he was working in wood and clay, and both of those are really tough to manage, and I think paper probably gave him a different avenue for sculptural exploration. It also can morph into a lot of things. It can look like a lot of things. So, right. You know, paper can be its beautiful self, or it can be painted or finished, you know.
Right.
So it's a really great medium for sculpture.
So you grew up, where did you grow up?
I grew up in a little town outside of Philadelphia called Pittman, New Jersey.
Pittman.
Yeah. Okay.
And you went to college for art?
I grew up outside of Philadelphia, which is a Quaker city. My mother was a very wonderful Quaker school educator. And so I made a choice to go for my first 2 years to Guilford College, which is a Quaker school. And then when I decided to go into art, I transferred to Virginia Commonwealth University and finished my degree there. But enjoyed my years at Guilford, and attribute probably a lot of my political bent and my work to having been there.
Uh-huh. So talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, the Quakers are really involved in activism, and activism was just a really big part of my youth, in the sense that spiritually they believe there's God in every person, and so the idea of social justice is major. So I feel like I spent my early childhood at Free Mumia and Leonard Peltier demonstrations.
Okay.
You know, that just was like a really big part. My mom was also just a very cool human being who would allow me to take time out of high school to go to the Ray Street Meeting Library. And I would research things like nuclear war and climate change. She really felt like I could learn as much by doing that in the Quaker library. And she was right. I think it spurred my interest in the complications of life and the responsibilities we have to try to make change.
And was your mother working? Or...
Yeah, she taught at Mullica Hill Friends School for, I think, 30-plus years. And her teaching there allowed us to attend for a number of years. Uh-huh. So we got some Quaker education and did our weekly meeting for worship. And anybody who's been raised around Quakerism is usually indelibly touched by having been a part of that uh-huh. community. It's pretty unique.
Right.
Yeah.
And are you involved at all?
There's an Oak Park meeting, which is kind of far away for us. Mm-hmm. Chicago's not really a Quaker city in that way, but I am reminded, I think the Quaker community would tell us that our worship space is where we are. So, yeah. You know, I really consider the things that I do part of that journey to consider their thought.
Right. And you're certainly still very active as an activist.
Yeah I try.
Awesome. Okay. So, anything particular happened at Virginia Commonwealth?
Well, I had mentors who are still intimate friends. So one of my very favorite mentors, Rennie Gower, was a professor mm-hmm. while I was there. She and I do a lot of work together. We actually have a traveling show. I invited her to come do her artwork here in this studio.
Ah.
And with Chris Flynn, our master printer, she produced a really extraordinary series of pulp-painted, cut sort of stencil pieces. And she was inspired to create a show called Pulped Under Pressure. And that's been traveling around the country. So, you know, my connections from that place are profound.
Mm-hmm.
VCU was a material intensive environment.
Mm-hmm.
And paper is a material. Mm-hmm. Though right. I live very conceptually, I can rely on my sort of more traditional hand building skills from VCU for sure.
Uh-huh.
That was not something at Rutgers. Rutgers was way more conceptual.
Right. So then you went to grad school.
I did at Mason Gross School of the Arts, where I worked at the Brodsky Center. I was the graduate assistant under Judith Brodsky and Lynn Allen and Eileen Foti, master printer, and Gail Deary, master paper maker. It was an amazing influence to be at this nexus of feminism and anti-racism and print and paper. And in looking back at that experience, Judith Brodsky had a singular vision to transform the art market through print and paper.
Uh-huh.
And I think that she will be acknowledged for that moving forward.
Uh-huh. Cool. And did you have a concentration there? Or?
It was print and paper, but it's an interdisciplinary degree, so they don't specify.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then we met shortly after that, I think.
Yep, at Dudonné.
Right.
Our connection was immediately the papermaker's garden. You moved on to do other projects, and I stepped right in
mm-hmm.
to work on that extraordinary project at PS 234. PS
yeah.
41, I think, was one of them, or Riverside Elementary. Any of these ringing a bell? Bank Street.
234. You must have expanded it. Maybe.
Well, it was a time in New York when there was a lot of funding for arts
yeah.
education,
right?
And you and I walked into this really interesting space. You know, we've lost a lot of that in the contemporary grant making community.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think that work, you know, your work at 234, which was the launch place, right?
Yeah.
Was that the launch place?
Yeah.
This is socially engaged practice, and I think it can be reframed in that discussion and manner, because it took pedagogy but designed it as a way for people to explore food, material, and ideas all in the same place. I mean, obviously its impact was huge because they kept it going for a long time. I mean, it really was a cornerstone. But yeah, it also ended up at a variety of places, and there were a lot of funders who let us. Do you remember all those years of taking the tubs, the heavy tubs, up the like 8 flights of stairs to go teach papermaking?
Oh, God. Yeah.
You know, we've lost our connection to that. It's so sad that the public schools have really cut that type of funding. That left with the Democrats. That left with Clinton and his Annenberg initiative.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were at Dudonné a couple of years.
I was there from 1997 to 2001. And then after Dudonné, which was a very teary goodbye, you know, the salary just was not possible. I had like 16 jobs on top of it, and I was so burnt out. And also not doing enough making. And I felt like, you know, it was really important for me to get back on my game in that way. And then I went to go be the education director at Irving Glass and stayed there for a while John Perrault was the director. And Brett Littman, who ended up taking the executive directorship at Dudonnet, was the deputy director.
Oh, at Irving Glass.
And
then I know, how many years were you in New York?
12.
Yeah. You also were involved at NISCA for a while. Is that right?
New York Foundation for the Arts. Nice. So yeah, I mean, no. NISCA, of course, funded all our Papermakers Garden projects, and Elizabeth Marina, our champion, remains a tight friend and somebody who admires your work tremendously. She's amazing. Yeah. But yeah, I went to New York Foundation for the Arts and kind of caught this moment when professional development for artists was taking off. Mm-hmm. So I became a program officer traveling to teach about grant writing and sort of career preparedness. I think that was definitely a movement. Also a time when there was a lot of funding. Much of that funding is dried up, but some of our funding came from Tremaine Foundation, which has still stayed in the game on that. But I helped build the NIFA source database, which was an extraordinary project. The first cataloging grants and opportunities for artists, United States artists. Uh-huh. So it was a massive project funded by the NEA and Urban Institute.
Right.
So that was a big project I worked on for 5 years. I think I was there for 5 years. Uh-huh. And I left NIFA for my first Fulbright to go build the papermaking studio at University of Belgrade.
All right. So, so you kept your hand in paper all that time,
always.
Or did you kind of take?
No, I mean, I always was. You know, Dudonnet brought me back for teaching, so I always taught there.
Right.
I also, you know, Mina was always very generous about using the studio, so I always had paper as a part of my extended practice in my exhibitions and work moving forward. I mean, you know, trying to have access to a papermaking studio, I think one of the reasons these media are so collaborative is you got to have some pretty serious guns to be able to pull off doing papermaking in a city like New York.
Right.
So Dudonnet was instrumental in making that medium possible. And so I was always invited back there, as we all are, because it really was a community space as much as anything else.
Right, and I just read that they got a really nice chunk of money for their new community space.
Awesome! Yeah, that is really great.
That's really so great. That's awesome. Let's talk about the Fulbrights a little bit.
Yeah, so
the impetus behind that.
Well, the impetus behind it was I have always wanted a Fulbright, and I think I knew people who had a Fulbright, but I just had my eyes on like that's the grant I want, because it kind of marries teaching and pedagogy, which I later sort of attribute more to like a social engagement with scholarship, and so. I was awarded in 2006 to build the studio at University of Belgrade. The professor, Biljana Vukovic, who I worked with there, had already been in residence, had come to visit Dušica Kirjaković at Lower East Side Print Shop, who Dudonnet worked with a lot, and we co-hosted programs with people from Serbia.
Okay.
So I got this bug. Because I knew something really amazing was happening in Serbia's art scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I started applying for grants. I had an Arts Link and then later a Trust for Mutual Understanding. So then I applied with a Fulbright. And, you know, Fulbright is such a wonderfully American program in that it rewards weirdness. It really does. And when I got to my orientation, I had the program officer stopping me like, Mel, Melissa Potter, you're that one who's going to take a machine to Serbia to make paper. You're that one. So, you know, they really reward that.
Yeah.
So, I built a studio, and you don't go to the Balkans without making friends for life. I mean, that's the whole nature and style of their culture. And from then on, I traveled like over 30 times. I mean, I've kind of lost count, but I just started going all the time. And then I had a senior Fulbright in 2009. Which was a partnership with the Ethnographic Museum. The Ethnographic Museum and my amazing colleague, Sasha Srečković, and also a bunch of other amazing people, Rale Petrovic, and just amazing people, guided my research. And I ended up doing a sort of a crafts inventory program with them in 2009. Mm-hmm. And then in 2015, I applied for a Fulbright to Bosnia and got another one. And I built a papermaking studio at the faculty. It's called the Academy of Fine Art, University of Sarajevo. So Fulbright's been really good to me, and it's offered me massive support to maintain what's really probably the largest body of work that I've done in my career.
Yeah, that's so great. And those studios are still thriving.
They are. And I did a performance at University of in Sarajevo with Adam Pantic, who was one of the builders and masterminds of the studio in Belgrade. So Biljana Vukovic has always, she toured me all over to all, I don't even remember the places where we went with what we called the paper circus. But so I now meet students who were part of that. And I recently met one who did his graduate thesis in paper. And I said to him, I was like, where did you learn paper making? And he looked at me like I was an idiot and said, from you. I was like, oh, okay. It's been that long. Uh-huh. And he was doing these, you know, just huge scale pieces where he was mixing pulp with glue and paint and doing these like painted pieces that he would use on a tarp. And wow. Build on a tarp. So I think that it brought a medium to a part of the world that had been so cut off. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it was just strange enough that it felt like an invitation to something interesting. So it had, paper had a stickiness over there that was so much bigger than anything about my having brought it. Uh-huh. It's part of what's so great about it being on the margins is it's slightly odd, slightly unusual.
Right. Well, you're quite a catalyst for lots of ideas.
Hey, listeners. Let's take a little break here, and I wanted to let you know about a new program over here at Helen Hebert's studio. I've started a free Facebook group called Club Paper. It's a place to share what you're working on, get encouragement when you need a little push, be inspired with new ideas, tips, tricks, books, and supplies, all having to do with paper. I hope to create a place over there where we feel like we're in a clubhouse working on projects and having a conversation together. We're building a paper community, one sheet at a time. Join us by going to Facebook and searching for the group Club Paper. Now back to the episode.
Did you always think you would teach?
Yes.
So you went to Rutgers to get an MFA in hopes of teaching.
I think for middle class people, which I definitely was, at the time that I went through graduate school, there were really two avenues to success. One, art star, which is like, you know, 0.0001 people, and also as a papermaking practitioner, probably the most unlikely of the scenarios, right? And then two, teaching.
Yeah.
I mean, my whole family are teachers, so for me this was an honor. This was not a default. It was an honor.
Right.
But teaching struck me as a way to have a creative life, and I really own the pedagogical process of teaching because curriculum is creative practice. And I do think, even though academia is nuts these days, thanks to late market capitalism, it is still a creative free zone where artists can be thinking through their making, thinking through their teaching. For me, this was like the road. And I really look back and think, God, I certainly have been very lucky to have made that possible or have had that been made possible by other people.
Right. So now what's your title here at Columbia College?
I'm an associate professor in the School of Art and Art History, the interdisciplinary department where I was a director of the MFA in Book and Paper merged with the Art and Art History program 3 years ago.
Okay.
And it's been a good merger. I mean, our students now have access to a much broader range of practitioners, which include performers, painters, art historians. So it's really expanded a lot in terms of what our students have access to. So
that's awesome. And you've got one of the probably the best papermaking studio in the country, if not the world.
Yeah, I mean, as I...
Talk
as
about
I,
the studio a little bit. Okay. Marilyn Sword
is so, yeah, Marilyn Sword and Barbara Metz mm-hmm. were responsible for bringing this incredible Center for Book, Paper, and Print, as it's now known, to Columbia College Chicago in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how founders get erased. So over time, Marilyn's name kept sort of being disengaged from the center. And I feel mm-hmm. like as a very important feminist practice, I am always bringing her name back up. I knew her when I worked with Sue Gozen on the Master Papermaker Apprenticeship Program, which she tried to bring into existence.
Right.
She was, as I was concerned, a heavy hitter, and I feel like this place should have been named after her. It's mm-hmm. my opinion that mm-hmm. that's how it should have gone. But I feel like part of my practice is to always make sure her name gets inserted back in.
Right.
It's the only program of its kind that came to an interdisciplinary program, mm-hmm. and its signature style came from that sort of strange alchemic space. She was a very creative, broad thinker who brought a lot of very unusual people to this space. And Columbia College is an unusual place, and they decided to house this, which at one point was 10,000 square feet of book, paper, and print studios in the historic Ludington building on Columbia's campus. And as I mentioned earlier, this paper studio is still so exquisite that I often take pictures when I come in and work, the light and the... Yeah. equipment and just the vibe of being in her space is very intense still for me, even after 12 years.
Right, right. And so what happens in this space? Classes, obviously. Are there other types?
There are a lot of things that happen in the space. For many years, we considered this a lab. Mm-hmm. And we invited people. We invited Sharon Alway Hakahiwe, who was a great colleague and friend of Laura Anderson Barbata's, to do 3 years in a row a project with our students interpreting his family's Yanomami heritage through paper, which was amazing, and networked through with museums and consulates all over the city. It was amazing. We hosted artists to make their work. I created credit-bearing programs to have things take place in here where students could use papermaking as a way to explore lots of themes about history and ethnography and science. And
mm-hmm.
So there's that. There also, my philosophy teaching in this space is that it's quite possible every student who comes through here will never have access to a space like this again.
Right.
And so what can we do to create a unique portfolio and signature style that can catapult from this space?
Mm-hmm.
And that, it takes a long time to be a good teacher. I don't think I'm any great shakes. Like, there are people, I think, who were born gifted in teaching. For me, it's been a process.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I've finally gotten to a place where I know how to give this kooky medium to my students.
Mm-hmm.
And have it be a transformative thing mm-hmm. for them by the nature of this medium.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my philosophy. So I really think that a lot of great work comes out of here. And that's at the intersection of hand papermaking and Columbia's really cool students. So, we get everything from stop motion paper animation to installation to paper engineering and design. The students are just, I love them so much and the things that have come out of this space.
Yeah, and you've done some pretty interesting projects out of this space, too. I think the Papermaker's Garden here, I want to talk about that a little bit, and Seeds in Service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So Papermaker's Garden was an initiative of a really amazing student named Alex Borgen,
mm-hmm.
and Jillian Bruchera of the Mobile Mill was also integral to that project. And Alex really yearned for being outdoors.
Uh-huh.
And, I actually started talking to her about Papermaker's Garden and my experience doing Papermaker's Garden in New York.
Uh-huh.
And I think it captured her imagination as something that would really bring her sort of physical practice to the work that she was doing as an artist. So she convinced Columbia at the time.
She was a student?
She was a graduate student. Mm-hmm. She convinced Columbia to invest $40,000 in building a 10-bed garden. Yeah, 10-bed. I don't even remember how big they were. Were they like 4 feet wide by 30 feet long? I don't even, it was crazy. Yeah. And really the scale of it was intense and crazy. On a lot at the intersection of 8th and Wabash. And it became, you know, just an explosive green space mm-hmm. on the Columbia campus, thanks to those students who brought it into being. And what happened was, all of a sudden I became responsible for 10 beds. And as you know from gardening, the Alex Borgens don't come across very often. Right. So there are lots of people who are perfectly happy to throw some seeds and then run off for the summer. So all of a sudden I found myself like, oh my God, I got to step up my game here. Right. So I talked to Maggie Puckett, who is one of our most incredible graduates, and said, what do you think of trying to do a project in this space that would bring our shared interest in paper as a radical craft and ecofeminism and all of these different ideas we have together? And then we'll take over 5 of those 10 spaces because there's no way to get more than 5 people at any given time devoted to doing a public space like that, and run our own project. So Seeds and Service ran from the inception of the garden, really the first cycle, through the last year when the Papermaker's Garden was closed. Mm-hmm. It's now the site of the Student Center. They told us that from the beginning. And it's been relocated to Compound Yellow Gallery out in Oak Park, which was Michelle Grabner, the curator of the, 2015 biennial, Whitney Biennial. Yeah. It was formerly her suburban, the gallery called the Suburban. Okay. And so it's this great hybrid of like a front yard space that Laura Schaffer, who runs the space, lets anybody do whatever they want. She's like, oh my gosh, garden, great idea.
Yeah.
So built some beds, did a thematic garden in the spirit of Seeds and Service, and have an exhibition and book launch this summer. So Seeds and Service is looking back at 5 years of seed saving, hand paper making, thematic gardening and hand paper making. It's been a really fun run, and ultimately inspired by Papermaker's Garden and the idea of all those ideas that generated in the work that we did in New York.
Right. So can you describe one of the Seeds and Service?
Yeah, sure. So our thematic beds range. Mm-hmm. Maggie has been working a lot on seeds endangered by war. So she partnered with the Experimental Farm Network and the Zapatista community to steward seeds and made a lot of artwork around those ideas. I brought a lot of my work in the Balkans into this. So I had a Bosnian magic garden, which was sort of exploring the ethnobotanical heritage that was sister to the work I was doing as a papermaker in Serbia, because it was the ethnobotanists who were helping me identify viable plants for those studios. Uh-huh. And that was a blast. And we would have things like tea events and performances and make tablecloths out of paper and make, you know, menu cards for dinner parties with food made from there. We just had fun and made like crazy, and we are a perfect pair. You know, it's like this for us all the time. So the themes of the garden produce the material for our art projects, which happen over the winter.
Right.
And they also produce food and herbs and medicinal plants and research. So we've also hosted projects like University of Wisconsin, thanks to my former chair, Michelle Citron. She hooked us up with plant pathologists at University of Wisconsin. And we did a potato vine project. And then that was really interesting because potato vines, like vines usually stink for papermaking. And I was very suspicious, but potato vine is actually a killer plant fiber for papermaking. And then, you know, the samples for that became our menu cards for a food performance that we did. So there's just, you know, there was a lot of paper as a process ends up being very labor intensive. And a lot of times the materials inspire me after they're made. Right. It's not always something that I dive in and say, this is how I want to make this. It's like those potato papers later became perfect for another project. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's been really interesting and fun.
Now, the ethnobotanical work, was your recent class at Haystack?
Yes.
That was the title.
Yeah.
So how do you approach that from that class? I'm just curious what fibers
so
you
fun.
Used and how you
yeah.
kind of orchestrated.
So, you know, from being at Haystack, I mean, I learned from Serbia to have my plan A, B, C, D, E, F, G, right?
Yeah.
So my baseline was I took some COSO and figured baseline, we do inclusions.
Right.
And then I got there and it's like, oh, hello. All the grass from the previous winter was dead and all the new material was coming up. Boom. We had a source fiber.
Mm-hmm.
We foraged. We did responsible foraging where you only pick up things that have already fallen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Deer Isle area is very intense for lichen. So people started calling us the lichen lab. So it was great for inclusions. But the idea was that we used paper making and book, you know, some very simple book structures as a way to interpret the natural environment because that's where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I knew I probably was going to get at least one really good what do you call a person who knows how to use a wildflower guide? Like one really good locator.
Right.
And I did.
Uh-huh.
And she was amazing. She got called the queen of the forest by one of the other students. And so we could rely on her to be like, oh, that's that. And that's what this is. And we started telling the stories about what these materials were used from, what their histories were, what personal histories they were. And so people started telling stories about the area through their use of those materials. It was a great, we had an incredibly good time, and Haystack let me kind of do all this work around ethnobotany and storytelling to a class. So I was really appreciative because it was the first time I got to kind of like brand that thinking around a class. And they did just beautiful work, really beautiful work.
Cool. So what other projects are you working on now?
So the center as an entity will close in 2019. And so my work over the past 18 months or so, and will continue through this year, is creating the legacy of this space and working very closely with our archives here at Columbia to make sure that the material that was generated here by such extraordinary makers and thinkers is properly documented.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to take up a lot of work, and it extends from the show that I did with Jessica Cochran, Social Paper, Hand Paper Making in the Context of Socially Engaged Art, which considers like, okay, we've got paper. We've got the city of Chicago at this historical moment. We've got this legacy of Marilyn Sword. Where do these things come together? Like, who is going to step up and try to spin that narrative? And Jessica was an amazing partner for that. And we did that through this idea of paper as a socially engaged medium. But I, you know, mentioned to you earlier, paper resists discourse for some reason.
Yeah.
And I never thought I was going to be doing as much writing and curating as I do. But I woke up and realized that I have to create the conversation around the things I make because nobody else knows what to do with them. So, you know, I found myself becoming a writer and a curator, not having been trained in either. And, you know, just like my teaching, I am no great shakes as a writer. I've had to work hard to be a writer. But now it's a big part of the practice. So I want, my goal, I guess, as a maker and a curator, if I can call myself that, and writer, is to have paper making, the legacy of paper making, as it's known in the United States, which is a singular history, enter the discourse the same way clay has entered the discourse in the craft community. And, you know, it's gotta be more than me. I can't do that. I mean, you know, it's got to be a movement, and you hope that there will be a catalyst to kind of make that happen. I think Mina at Hand Paper Making has done an extraordinary job driving the traffic. And now I think it's going to just really take somebody who's got legs in the art history world or art criticism world to say, like, yes, That is something unusual that's happening, and it needs to be cataloged. And, you know, until that happens, you and Mina and I and our students are going to create the content for what I hope is going to happen one day. I think it will.
Yeah.
It's building into a crescendo. And I try to remember, you know, Sue opening Dudonne, what was it, in 73 or something? 76, early
76. Maybe,
it hasn't been that long, okay?
Right.
So
right.
You know, sometimes you have to be patient for these things. Yeah. Clay, the Renaissance of clay happened much earlier in the United States. So we just need a little more time, I think.
Okay, well, that's great. Thanks, Melissa.
Sure, thank you.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay updated is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio in Colorado. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you listen to the podcast on a regular basis, you'll notice I've done a bit more editing than usual. This is thanks to the help of Gary A. Hansen. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about Gary and his services. Subscribe to this series via iTunes. You can also leave a review. I'd appreciate that. And listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.